We've qualified for the World Cup. Go and compete.
So welcome to Season 2, Episode 5 of This Is Football, sponsored by Tesco's Express. And later on in the show, we have League of Ireland and FIFA referee Rob Harvey coming up. A great interview. Before we get into that, how are you, lads?
Yeah, all good, Paul.
All good, how are you? Yeah, we're jumping in.
Are you waiting for the lads again? Yeah, fair play to you.
Yes.
How was your Paddy's weekend?
Fun. Good weekend. Good results.
Yeah. Scott was diving off the tee box on Sunday. Travis diving under the rock.
Yeah, we'll see. Anyway, come on, let's just get us over. I hate this stupid part.
I'll let you go with him, Scott. Wait, but
we're going to go. Burnley-Brentford.
Let's get into Trevor's predictions. Let's see how we got on last
week. We go League of Ireland first. So Bowes and Derry was the first game up. Of course, me as a loyal fan of Bowes went for Bowes. Paul, who's a Rovers fan, clearly could see the wood from the trees and thought, well, it's obviously going to be Bowes against Derry. Scott, the loyal Bowes fan, said away win.
It was the reverse jinx. The old, reverse jinx at work. You know, everyone thought
they were... Can you just put a record on the shells, man?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Paul. No, the reverse jinx, lads. I knew what I was doing, you know, doing it for the greater good of my club, and just glad it worked out for me.
Do you know what you do when you fall off the tee box?
You actually bet against your own team. Get out of that league and garden. They're cheeky. I wouldn't even say...
We're going to move on. No. Move on, because that's just highly embarrassing. Dundalk and Waterford. So that was a draw. So Paul, you said draw, I said away win, and Scott, you said draw. So two of you's got that. Galway and Rovers. Paul, you said away win. I said away win. Scott, you said draw. So obviously myself and Paul got that. Pats and Shells. We all went 1-0 home. Alex, what's the crack? So he let us down, and so did Connor Keighley. So they lost 2-1 at home to Shells, and we all got that wrong. So we'll go to the final scores after the rest of the predictions. So we had Burnley and Brentford in the league, in the Premier League. Paul, you said Burnley. No, we're going to give the... No, but it's all... What are we going to... Do you want to do a separate then? Okay, so separately then, Paul, you got 1-2-3. I got 1-2-3. Scott, you got one, and it wasn't even your own team. So Scott lost. Yeah. All right. Yeah, expert. Yeah, you came in for the League of Ireland expert side of things. Brilliant. And Burnley and Brentford.
League of Ireland expert.
It was Guru. He said.
And he said expert. He can't even get his own team right.
Burnley versus Brentford, that ended. What score was that game, guys? Oh, Burnley won. So Paul, you said home win, you got that. I said draw. Scott, you said draw. So Paul's one up. Anyway, Luton Forest, we all said home win. That was a draw. We all got that wrong. So still 1-0 to Paul. Fulham Spurs, Paul said away. That's wrong. I said away. That's wrong. Scott, you said draw. We all got that wrong. Fulham are really comprehensive 3-0 winners there. Spurs being Spurs again. West Ham versus Villa. That was a draw, wasn't it? So, Paul, you said home. That was wrong. I said draw. I got that right. And you also said home, Scott. So, in the Premier League, Paul, you got one right. I got one right. And, Scott, you got none. Sorry, Scott. So... We drew.
Did you make any money in the bookies with them predictions, would we?
No, myself and Paul.
Now we're going to the FA Cup. Nobody really watched any of these games, so we'll just fly through these. Chelsea and Leicester. So I said away win just for the crack. Youth both at home in, so obviously that was correct. So Paul and Scott, you're not gonna get the wooden spoon this time, Scott. Oh, actually, you're gonna win this section. So United and Liverpool. I think it was United won. I think they won. So you, Scott, you guessed that and you got that right. And myself, actually, Paul, you said -2 for Liverpool. So you're definitely wrong there. So Scott wins the middle section of two games.
I never had so much crack in the pub, lads, watching that match, because whoever was winning, I was cheering for, and I was driving the other set of fans mad, and it was deadly crack.
Yeah, sounds like you, all right.
Deadly crack. Trev, you're not supposed to dive into these matches here. Come on, let's dive into it. You were whinging and moaning, and you were texting on the group saying, they should have got a penalty, or offside. She wasn't offside. How would you be offside with your hand?
Well done, Manchester United.
You can't be offside with your shoulder.
Well done, Manchester United, for making it through to their final. I know it's a semi-final, but it's a final for them, because obviously that's the only thing that they have to go for this season. But congratulations, they wanted it more. That was Liverpool's. Liverpool weren't great. United, in fairness, United should have won it in normal time with Rashford in the last minute. So all joking aside, United wanted it more. Liverpool weren't up for the fight, and they got what they deserved, which is nothing. So well done.
Yeah, best game of football I've seen all year. I think it was just like,
Scott, get back on the tee box there. The best game of football. It was rubbish.
Yeah. In terms of drama.
And excitement, right.
Halfway through the match, I was getting bored. This playing brilliant.
Ah, no way.
You obviously know. Paul, you watch the Scottish League every week. How can you say that?
Yeah, but at least it's competitive. Christ. Not like...
The Scottish League's competitive.
Between two teams.
Should only one team seems to win it in England, and it's City. What are you talking about? You know, you haven't won it in years. Liverpool won it once in 42 years. Get out of that garden. I'll definitely get a ref on.
Listen, if Burnley got relegated and went up to the Scottish League, they'd win the league. Would you stop?
Yeah.
What's your opinion on
Scott's best game he's ever watched in his life?
Yeah, recent history. Unbelievable game. I was like yourself, Paul. I was actually in a pub in town, and the place was packed out. It was 50-50 between Manx and Scousers, as they'd say, and it was just, the crack was unbelievable. You know, one set of fans we get.
Yeah, all joking aside, it was a proper cup tie.
Just, you know, when the game goes to extra time, sometimes it dies. It just seemed the opposite for that game. It just got more mad and mad and mad. And obviously, last minute winner, and the place absolutely erupted. Like, I can't stop watching the videos of the last minute winner, and just the ones, no commentary, it'd just be some guy on the sideline taking a camera, kicking camera out and seeing the crowd go mental. It's just a proper cup tie. It was unbelievable.
Well, there was only one team that tried to win it in extra time, and it was United. Liverpool didn't want to know. So I'm not taking it away from United. United wanted it more, and they won it. Like, Liverpool just, I don't know what went on with them. But as far, like, the games are not normally great. Like, you know, the nil all at Anfield in December was probably one of the worst games I've seen in a long time. And they are normally tight. Like, the highest quality games that you see in the Premiership at the moment are Liverpool and City, and that was only a few weeks ago. But as for excitement, I do agree, obviously I'm not a neutral, but if you're a neutral watching that, and if you are a United fan, it's a great game. But United deserve to go through. United came out flying, though.
Of Liverpool, you know, they should have went 3-1 up. Liverpool missed that opportunity. And then to let the game go end to end, like, you're playing Russian roulette. You know,
yeah.
I thought Liverpool lost their shape. I don't know what went about. It was a great game.
It was crazy. Like, Bruno was playing centre half in extra time, and Anthony was playing left full in extra time. It's one of those games you don't know what's going on, but you're just like, I can't take my eyes off it. I was impressed by United, though, in the first half. I thought they were excellent. Liverpool did control the game, but I always thought United had the chances, which was nice to see compared to the City game 2-3 weeks ago, where they just weren't in the game at all. It was nice to see them in the game, actually taking it to the opponent. I just can't really sum it up more than that. It was just some game. I just loved every minute of it. Well, and United won in the end.
I think I think I said to Paul, I think the first 10 minutes, United just came, and rightly so, it was a cup game, they were playing at home, and United just came at Liverpool, and obviously deservedly went 1-0 up. I think from minute 11, 12, up to the 70th that minute, I think they controlled the game, but they didn't really look too threatening. But United always had that threat in behind, and it was always going to be a case of, if you get this wrong, you're in trouble. And they did get it wrong. Not that they got it wrong. United got it right. I'm not giving United credit. United got it right. They stung them on the counter-attack. And, you look at it, so United have got Coventry in the semi-final. Obviously, they'd be huge favourites at Wembley as well. Coventry are a good team, but you'd expect United to get through, and then you have City and Chelsea, and you would expect City to get through. City United final, I would take all day long, and I would take Man United winning that all day long too. So, but obviously there's two games to go before that happens. But no, look, it was for the Paddy's Day. I wasn't watching it in the pub. I was sitting at home watching it, and part of me would have loved to be in the pub, and part of me wouldn't. But they're the games you remember. No, but like they're the games you remember. Whether you win, lose, or draw, you remember where you were. You remember what happened in them, and that's what it's meant to be about. Like, you know.
Yeah, it's a kind of a that's why I love football game. Yeah,
it was look, a proper
as you said,
when
Scott
he broke 2-1 when he broke out of box 2-1 in a 2v1 for such a long distance. Like it was 2v1, and the ball he played through them was brutal. It looked like he played behind him, and that added to the drama. It was really like, and then
look in.
The key kind of got through it. Where's it going in? It hits the post, goes in, and it was mental. But
if he never does a thing for United, if he never does scores a goal or walks onto a pitch for United again, he'll always be a cult hero. Because he scored at the Stretford end, last minute against Liverpool, took his jersey off, got sent off, and didn't give two flying you-know-whats about it. And he was absolutely right, because he's only a kid. Like, he couldn't... That's Ryder over stuff, so fair play to him. Like, you know, really, he took it well, because, as you said, he had a lot of time to think about it. And sometimes, even the best players, when you give them time to think about what they're going to do with the ball, they mess it up. So, all credit to him. He was a good finish, with a bad pass, as you said, Paul. So that's the last time I'll praise United. I genuinely do hope they go on and win it now. And I always say this, I've more friends of United fans than I do of City or Chelsea or Coventry. So I'd like to see them do it. Why not? Keep Ten Hag there for another season and we'd be all happy.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah. Well, let's bounce on. I suppose we'll bring in Rob Harvey's interview now in a minute. And we'll discuss the Liverpool, what's wrong with me? I'm getting tired. The Ireland upcoming matches, we'll discuss them next week, lads, to see who gets in as the interim manager.
Yeah, John O'Shea. It'd be interesting to see. Will there be a huge change or not? But yeah, we'll have to see, watch the games and discuss it all next week.
In that. All right, so up next we have Rob. So welcome to the podcast, mate.
Thanks very much, Paul. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I suppose first, Rob, what we'll do is we're going to send you straight over to Scott. Scott has a couple of questions for you. So, Scott, do you want to lead us in there, mate?
Yeah, we'll do. So, little snippet into my life. Rob was my first football coach at St. Kevin's. So I know everyone doesn't know that. I know. But I was just going to ask, Rob, you know, I obviously know you started off coaching, and did that kind of lead into the refereeing? I believe you did it at the time as well, like kind of, you know, on the Sunday. Just basically given your football background, because at the end of the day, referees are also fans of the game as well.
Yeah, it did actually, yeah. So it would have been the first couple of years. Like, your team was actually also the first team that I'd ever coached. So going back, it's gone back 23, 24 years now with Kevin's. I played with Kevin's, and at about the age of 14 or 15, I just got an interest in going down on a Saturday. They still have a thing called the mini leagues, and that was for kids before under 7. And it was just an hour or two on a Saturday, and I went down and volunteered. And I'd been there a year or two, and then they'd mentioned it to me about, you know, would you like to go in with a team? Age group was the first time I'd gone in, but under 7s. And I think I was with your team for 2 years, Scott, and then I moved on. I think by the time you went under 9s or 10s, when I got a little bit more serious, kind of, I was still quite young. So when I would have been coaching your team, I would have been, you know, I would have been 15, 16, kind of still playing and coaching. So I would have then coached on a Saturday with your team, played on a Sunday for Kevin's for a while, and then when after 18s, Kevin's in the AUL, and I was a B team goalkeeper, so I went down and played Sunday morning football with a team called Whitehall Celtic. And it became a bit of a juggling act, really. Like, I was coaching your team twice a week, match on a Saturday. I was training with my own team twice a week, match on a Sunday. And then I started college, actually, and kind of that was the thing that changed everything for me in terms of what my priority was. Because, like you said, I did used to coach you on a Saturday, and then I would have refereed the Sunday team games, because in the DDSL then, there's no referees up until under 11s. Now, I don't know how it is now, but back then that was the case. It was a club volunteer, basically. So I would have coached the Saturday team, refereed the seven-a-side game on a Sunday, and then gone out and played myself. And I think, I don't know, you might remember, but it was one of the Duffies. I don't know whether you had any of the Duffies on your team, but there's a Leinster Senior League referee, Colly Duffy. He had four boys that all went through Kevin's. And one of his young friends was on one of the teams I coached. And he actually said to me, if you went and did a referee's beginner's course, you could still do your coaching on a Saturday. You could do these couple of games on a Sunday, but then you could go out into a league and get paid for it. So I left it kind of in the background for a while. And then, you know yourself, then when you start college and you're looking kind of for a job that gives you a few bob in the pocket. In December of 2005, I went off and did a beginner's course. And then started refereeing in the North Dublin Schoolboy League on a Sunday, because Kevin's were DDSL, and I didn't want to, you know, any kind of conflict. I didn't want to referee games involving Kevin's and stuff. And then, kind of long story short, I did 6 months more of playing, and then effectively retired from playing in 2006 at the age of kind of 19. A retirement long overdue, if you talk to some of my teammates, you know, but. Kind of refereeing picked me or hit me in a way that playing and coaching didn't, you know. I enjoyed being involved with a team, but I didn't necessarily want to be the main person in charge of a team. And then playing, like I said, I was a B team goalkeeper. I played Sunday league football. But I think mainly because of my age at the time, very quickly I got into decent games in the Brentford. Like, I was refereeing Brentford Premier, which kind of back in those days wasn't too far away from DDSL Premier in terms of Premier. Very, very quickly, refereeing offered me more. And then look, as well, being a 17, 18-year-old in college, if I did three or four games for a weekend, that was my few bob for college for the week. And it kind of just progressed from there.
Yeah, I'd say it was very difficult to, you know, manage all that. I mean, you'd refereeing, coaching, playing. I fell into the trap of taking up a coaching a team here in Dunboyne. It was actually my brother's team. It was like I had them from under fives to I think 15, 16, so 10 years at it. And I with college as well, it was very tough. It was actually, my dad was a big help in that. I'd work with him, so he'd kind of, you know, let me off and go and do the coaching and all that. But so you'd have to be mad into football to be doing all that, Rob.
Yeah, well, mad in general, I suppose. There was, but definitely there was, I do remember at some points, because for 1 year, my whatever team I was with Kevin's coaching, they trained on the same night as Whitehall Celtic. And then the Whitehall Celtic actually had a goalkeeping coach, and he said, look, if you can make one session a week fully, that'll be enough for goalkeeping. So I was like, right, I'll definitely do that. But then it became a case where I was making it down for maybe 40 minutes of the hour at Whitehall Celtic or something. And just eventually I knew something had to give. I mean, even when you're that young and you have all that energy, there is going to be burnout at some point. So like I said, I still stayed coaching for a bit, but playing was the first thing to go. And then, I mean, there's still an issue in terms of numbers with referees. Like, it's better now, but there's still not enough referees. So all of a sudden, you do your few games on a Sunday. Then after a few weeks, you get a call and say, can you do a game on a Saturday, you know? So it just, refereeing just took over. I could do as much or as little as I wanted, really.
Yeah, Rob, just jump in there. I think you just hit the nail on the head. I was going to go back to you on something that you were saying, the DDSL under 11s. You don't have refs up to. I think that's still the same. I think that's just down from the lack of referees, really. I know that NDSL is, they'll have refs at 10s if they can on 11s, but DDSL really under 12s.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't have much of a look now at the schoolboy leagues, but certainly at the time, the DDSL was significantly bigger in terms of numbers. So I think it just simply couldn't offer the same amount of referees. And then, I mean, I suppose that's 20 odd years ago, but you look at it now and you kind of think, if you're trying to move away from competitive football, then actually not having referees at 7, 8, 9, 10 is probably a better idea, because it takes a bit of that pressure away. So yeah, but certainly at the time it was simply just sheer volume of games. They just simply couldn't put referees out into 7-a-side football.
Yeah, I think it's still the same. I think, like, there is a lack of referees. Mm. It's a pity. There should be more referees. Now, I know, as my own lad has just done the TY year, and I think there's 5 or 6 from Rathdowell that they're doing, which is great. They're out there doing the PDP ones, twos, and the refereeing courses, which is great. So hopefully we see a rise in referees. Would you have any advice for young referees kicking off? Anything at all?
I mean, I'd have plenty, but I mean, you don't want to get into too many things, but certainly kind of just have to be an acceptance that, look, it's a sad reality of refereeing, but if you're going to become a referee and you're not aware that it's probably one of the most challenging things in football, I think kind of advice for it is to have, like a support group of people that you check in with. Because certainly I remember my first few games, they just seemed to pass in a blur, and you get caught in how many decisions you have to make in a game. You know, like in a standard 90-minute match now, a referee will make over 200 decisions. You know, lots of them are trivial. They're little free kicks here and there, throw-ins, goal kicks, corner kicks. But obviously then some of them aren't trivial. Some of them are bigger match-affecting decisions. But there was a statistic that the GAA, the IRFU, and the FAI got together a couple of years ago about retention on referees, and they went to government. And one of the statistics that they had was that I think over 60% of referees packed it in within, I can't remember exactly, but it was a low month. I think it was within a year and a half of beginning refereeing, 60% of people who'd done a beginner's course were gone. And, you know, we can't hide from that. I think that the vast amount of those cases are the level of critique or the level of abuse that they're subjected to. I laugh. All the jobs I've done in my life, I worked in a pub, which isn't immune from abuse, you know, particularly at closing time, I suppose. And now I'm a teacher and I've 20 odd in a class who some of them want to work and some of them don't, and some of them do homework and some of them don't. And then refereeing. So every environment I've been in, you know, there's been conflict, and there are jobs that require certain skills. So certainly if you have a certain interest in jobs like that, or you're good at conflict management, it's good. But definitely a referee beginning off, look for as much support as possible. Like I mentioned him earlier, a guy called Colly Duffy, he's still refereeing in the Leinster Senior League now. I would have rang Colly a couple of times a week, you know, or immediately after a game. And he would have told me to do that as well. He would have said, you know, if there's anything ever happens in your game, give me a call. And simply just having maybe even one little link was enough to kind of go, do you know what? No, I know that I can talk to this fella and I know that he thinks of it. And Colly would have come out and watched a couple of games at the start. So it's kind of about building a support structure, because it's not something you can do on your own. You know, Jesus, like the stuff that's involved. And if you get into refereeing and you think you're going to look after yourself until you finish refereeing, it's a very sad existence. So, yeah, but certainly building the support structure, I think, is probably one of the most important. It could be in your home, it could be with your friends, it could be with other referees, any other football people, coaches in your own club. It doesn't really matter. Just someone you can talk to about matches or incidents and bounce things off. For kind of outside perspective, really.
Great answer. Great advice. Trev, do you want to bounce in on that here?
Just on the refereeing itself, we've had it a few times where you kind of, everyone obviously thinks it's an easy job to do. You always do. You're standing on the sideline, you're a coach, you're a parent. What are you doing? You're completely wrong there. And then you stand, as I've said this a few times, I've done a friendly or two here and there when the ref doesn't turn up, or we just don't have a ref. Yeah. And you go into the middle and it's like a different sport, never mind your mindset is different. What would be one of the things that you probably would struggle with regards to the laws of the game, or just something that you couldn't get your head around, or you found that you needed a bit of help, like what you said with your mate coming out and having a look? What was one thing that maybe you didn't think maybe was an issue and it was, or vice versa, you know?
It's funny, it's something that's still an issue now depending on the game. So the vast majority of games I do now involve two assistants and a fourth official, so you have a team on each game. But there'd be the odd time where maybe I'd be asked to do an underage friendly or a behind closed doors game, and it might just be the referee And even now, refereeing 19 years, if I have to go back and do a game without assistance and call offside on my own, you know, with a single referee, not that it's guesswork, but it's educated guesswork. You can never be fully certain. And certainly when I started refereeing, because like that, I said to Scott earlier, I would have refereed the seven-a-side games and there's no offside in that. And then I went out into 11-a-side football and all of a sudden, like, honest to God, it did. In the first couple of games, you actually forget, or I forgot that, oh yeah, I'm the one deciding offside here, that, or I have to decide offside here. So definitely at the start, that's a big challenge. And you very seldom see referees reverse decisions. You kind of have to stick, even if after you've blown the whistle and the game stopped, you realize you've made a mistake. Not really anything you can do to go and erase it. But like I said, still 20 years later, I'll go out and I'll do a game on my own. And it takes a bit of tuning back in to realize, oh yeah, this is an added responsibility, because I have the luxury of having two assistants in every game who will do that for me. But definitely, that was probably the biggest thing at the start, because like that, if you're playing football and coaching football, you have a knowledge of the game, maybe not necessarily a knowledge of the laws, but you know what a foul is, roughly or not, or an advantage, and simple things, goal kicks, corner kicks, throw-ins, they're all kind of fairly straightforward. But definitely offside was a big thing at the start. And it's maybe why I didn't make it as an assistant and ended up as a referee.
If there was one message, Rob, you could get out to parents and coaches on the sideline, what would that message be to them for a young referee coming into the game? If you could nail down a couple of points or just simplify it to parents and coaches who don't know the laws of the game, or never even mind the laws of the game, don't know how hard it is to stand in the middle and ref. Is there anything you could say to them?
I think it's just about having an awareness, you know. Like we've seen that there's some very good ads out there. The FA are very good at putting out ads every now and again. And maybe you've heard about it. It's the one where there's two dads standing on the side of the pitch and they're chatting away. And one dad says to the other, you know, oh, which lad is yours? And you know, he's a seven, he's the right winger. And he says, all right, Jay, why do you want to know? And he says, well, I want to scream abuse at him. And his dad said to the other fella, he says, well, what do you want to do that for? And the first dad says, well, my lad is the one refereeing it, and you've been screaming abuse at him. So it's probably a little bit about having that perspective. I mean, I know I don't want to get hung on up on no referees, no game, because if we'd no coaches, we'd have no game. And if we'd no players, we'd have no game. Obviously, the referees are the ones who get the more criticism in that area. But I don't know of another environment where criticism can be so freely given from a point where people don't understand. And there I'm kind of getting technical about things in law. Like, I've got criticism at League of Ireland level from players who didn't realise that 4 years ago you can now be offside in your own half of the field of play. Like, I had a game a couple of years ago, League of Ireland Premier Division game, involving a player who was previously an Irish international. And his attacker came back from an offside position, played the ball in his own half. So the opposing team took the free kick for offside about 10 yards into the other half of the field. And as the game went on, that player ran at me and ran with me to critique a decision from a point in law that had changed 3 years ago. And I remember saying at the time, that's a player who has played international football. And he didn't know, not a very simple law change, but it's a law change that would affect him as a defender. So I would just say to, you know, like we all get emotional, referees get emotional, players and coaches and parents, we all get emotional, but I don't critique players. I wouldn't dare critique a player on the pitch, nor would I critique a coach, because I don't do their job. I don't know what's involved. I don't know the pressures, and I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on it. And lots of the critique that comes from sidelines from parents, I suppose, in particular, is, you know, it's biased. It's certainly biased anyway. It's either a decision for their team or it's wrong. You know, it's not a right or wrong decision. It's either goes for us and that's grand, or it goes against us and it's wrong. So, yeah, it would probably just be to be a little bit more aware, to maybe think about, I mean, if a referee makes a mistake, you know, we're not immune from criticism, and we should get criticism when we make mistakes, and that's part of life. But certainly getting criticism from people who maybe aren't au fait with the laws of the game and are critiquing you for something that's actually wrong. So kind of that, maybe just that, yeah, the awareness really would be the biggest thing, particularly with young people as well. You know, it's a big thing for a young person to referee a match, whatever, but an now lad who's a bit of experience behind him. a 16, 17, 18-year-old getting out on the pitch, it's a big deal, you know, it's a really big deal. And that kind of critique in the early days, like I go back to the stats I said about earlier, is probably the reason why 60% of them don't stay around.
Very good. I think there's a thing in the FA, correct me if I'm wrong, or you might know something of this, I don't know, I think we talked about it on the podcast going way back, Trev, that there's, I'm nearly sure in the FA, if you're 16, 15, 16, 17, you wear the yellow band or a yellow
band. Yeah, they do. Is that correct? Yeah, they do, yeah. Yeah, and do you know what? Like, it's probably like a visible clue, and maybe it's a visible barrier because it's obvious to everybody then that actually not as a young, but the referee is a minor. And we get into a whole different ball game there, I suppose. But yeah, it is, and it's an initiative that I think is very positive, because it's a physical thing that people look at and they see and they know straight away. I'm not talking to an adult here. I'm talking to a minor. This is a young person. You know, this person is learning, and like a player, like a coach, they have to make mistakes to get better. You know, you don't learn if you're not. No referee has never made a mistake, and you have to make mistakes in any walk of life to develop and to progress, both yourself and in what you're doing. But it just seems to me maybe refereeing mistakes are certainly talked about more, and they seem to be bigger than a player's mistake. You know, they're forgiven an awful lot. Players are forgiven an awful lot quicker for their errors than referees might be.
Brilliant stuff, lads. Can I just come in there?
Yeah, sorry, Scott. I know you're about to jump in, but I'll forget this. So just, you're obviously, it's easy for when we get a referee on, it's like, you know, it's quite easy, and it shouldn't be, but it's quite easy to talk about the problems or the challenges. But can you think of an example of when you, and I'm not a referee, so I can't really understand it, but where, for example, that you let the play go, you played the advantage and the goal was scored and you nearly want to be celebrating with them, but you can't because it looks like you're biased. But like, I'm sure there's occasions like that you've really kind of nailed it yourself, and you know, well, you have.
This is going to sound like a setup because this actually happened on Friday night. So I refereed St. Pat's and Shells last Friday in Richmond Park, and a fantastic crowd, like lots of grounds around the country now, sold out, you know, days in advance of the match. And with it being a Dublin derby and with the start that Shelburne have had, and Pats are the cup winners and they're a strong team as well, you know, you're kind of looking at, you know, we find out our games on a Sunday. So from the Sunday afternoon when I knew what game I had, I was looking forward to it all week. And as part of looking forward to it, you're saying to yourself, you know, I want to mentally prepare well here. I don't want to be a reason why this game is decided. So I don't want a decision that I make to impact the game, because then all the talk would be about that. So as you can imagine, a Dublin derby, but not just because it's a Dublin derby, but most League of Ireland Premier Division games now are quite closely contested. But this one, for obvious reasons, was probably going to have that little bit more edge to it because they're near neighbours. And throughout the game, in a game that's close like that, you probably get more more shouts from players for free kicks and decisions for them. And they're maybe looking at what the other teams are getting, and they're paying closer attention to it because the game is that tight. And again, in a game like that, you're probably thinking, there's a possibility for a lot of yellow cards in a game like this because the two teams involved, because what's at stake. And the game ended up being decided by one goal anyway. So like I said, it was quite close. So what you're doing during the match then is you're trying to see, is there opportunities for me to maybe give the benefit of the doubt on a card? So maybe there might be a situation where in another game, it would be a nailed on yellow card. But in a different game, you probably think, I might have 7 or 8 yellow cards here and I might need this opportunity not to give one. So that was kind of the case on Friday night. You know, we ended up with 9 yellow cards. I mean, 3 of them were in injury time for Shelburne when they were 2-1 up. So as a referee, as a fan, you expect that when a team are 2-1 up in injury time, they're going to, you know, delay the restart. And that's what they did on 3. So like a third of the yellow cards came between the 92nd and the 97th minute, all for delaying the restart. But coming back to a decision where, yeah, you're not celebrating, but playing an advantage that leads to a goal is probably the closest thing a referee will ever have to scoring. And, you know, and it doesn't matter who does it. But what it does is it shows that you've just read that part of the game, even if it's only one part of the game, you've read it perfectly and you've refereed it, not perfectly, but you've read it exactly the way it should be read. And you've allowed something to happen by not intervening. So the situation with Shelburne's second goal, ball is played forward towards Liam Burt and he's fouled. And Sean Boyd was quite close to Liam. And Sean is Sean's a combative centre forward. He's a target man and he's involved in a lot of tussles And sometimes you give free kicks against them, and sometimes you give free kicks for them, and sometimes you don't, because you're kind of thinking, I want a little bit of a fair battle to go on. But Sean, as that tackle went in, Sean was shouting for a free kick. And just out of the corner of my eye, I'd seen Will Jarvis was completely free. And all of a sudden, in waiting 1 second or 2 seconds, the ball is played back from Liam Burt. I can't remember exactly who it was played back to. And in one pass, Will Jarvis has possession in the penalty area and he scores. So like you said, referees don't celebrate that stuff, because, you know, at the end of the day, we don't really care who wins or loses. It's no impact on us. But if I'd have blown a free kick as the ball goes to Jarvis and he scores and it hits the back of the net, everyone talks about that's a terrible decision. Why didn't he wait? And we would feel bad as well, because we know what we've deprived. But like that, going back to last Friday, that's a moment where you just think, in that passage of play, I've read it exactly as it should be read. And as a referee, sometimes the hardest thing to learn is when not to blow the whistle. You know, it's easy to put the whistle out and blow it and go, that's a free kick. But it's sometimes it's more difficult to take a chance and see how something develops. And it doesn't always work out like it did last Friday. Sometimes it doesn't work out at all. Sometimes the ball will go to him and he'll miss control and a defender will get it. And you'll curse yourself and you'd say, I should have given the free kick. But on this occasion, on Friday, it paid off and they scored. And like I said, they won 2-1. So it was, did that one decision impact the game? No, but it had a hand in a passage of play working out the way the team would have preferred it to work than blowing the whistle and giving the free kick and maybe taking the safer option.
Well, I had a double on that Shelbourne to win. So I was delighted with you, Rob. Thanks very much for that. I can say that as a neutral, you know. Scott, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I'm just going to dial it back, Rob. I was actually, you know, my dad, he gave me an interesting one to ask you. Like, what's the actual, so obviously you did the refereeing, you did the Brentford leagues. What's the actual path to become a League of Ireland ref? I mean, is it a rigorous process? Is it kind of, you apply for it, you get assessed, or what's the actual path to become?
It's a bit like playing in some ways. So you have to do a beginner's course, obviously you have to be certified, and then you go out into a league. When you do your beginner's course, you can kind of preference. You know, there's basically a section back then that asked, is there a league you'd like to be assigned to? And when I was doing my beginner's course, everybody wanted the DDSL, the AUL, the Leinster Senior. But I was involved with Kevins, who are DDSL and AUL. And I was like, oh, well, I don't want those leagues. And Leinster Senior is quite a good standard. You know, it's a very high standard. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to go into schoolboy and see if I like it. So I put down the North Dublin because I'm from North Dublin. Now, it's funny you bring it back. I say I did 6 months and then I retired from playing, but I also decided schoolboy football wasn't for me. And it's coming back to something Paul said, actually, it was about parents. So I was 17 refereeing schoolboy football. And in the May of 2006, I called the referees allocator from the North Dublin League and said, I can't do this. I said, I have no problem refereeing and I'm really enjoying that side of it, but I was spending a significant amount of time dealing with sidelines. And I mean, Scott, like yourself and your dad know me a while. Your dad will probably say this about me, in that I've always been an older head on young shoulders. But certainly at 17, dealing with sidelines is a really difficult thing. And it's not something you want to be doing. I wanted to be refereeing games and helping games to be facilitated. So Gary Tolan was the referee's allocator's name. And he said to me, you know, I completely understand, Rob. And he said, I tell you what I'm going to do. He said, I'm going to ring the allocator from the Amateur Football League. And I'm going to tell him that you'll give him a call. And he said, don't leave refereeing. He said, go to him, do a few senior games. He said, if you don't like it and you want to come back to us, you can always come back. He said, if you don't like it altogether and you pack it in, look, you've done junior, schoolboy and senior football. And he said, look, and if you like it and you like it, and all the best, and you know, best of luck with it. And like after two or three games, it was just idyllic. And it's not that you don't want criticism, but in the amateur league at the time, it did have maybe three or four junior divisions. Now it's entirely over 35, I think. But I was going out to games where there were the 11 players, maybe some teams would have two subs, some teams might have five subs, and it was one or two coaches and a man and his dog. You weren't dealing with anything on the side. You were entirely dealing with what was on the pitch. And I think probably because of that age, it suited me an awful lot better. Because particularly, I think at that level of football, at my age, I was as fit as them. So I could keep up with play without any trouble. So that wasn't a critique that could be given at me. I like to think I've always been good at communicating. So that was another strength that I had. So whatever mistakes I might have made, I might have got a bit of leeway because, well, he was up with play constantly. And you can talk to him, you know, and he can explain things. So that was my journey. I did 6 months in the amateur league, and or 6 months in the Brentford, and then I did 3 seasons in the amateur league. And then there are the referee observers. So in the League of Ireland, they cover every game. There's a referee observer on every single match. But in junior football, they go to different referees, different weeks. Obviously, there's not enough of them to cover every game. So I was a referee observer with them, actually. Ignatius Martin, was the one in the amateur league at the time. And Ronnie Marsh, the two of them were in charge of whatever, 40, 50 referees. And the two of them nominated me for the FAI School of Excellence. So a bit like the Emerging Talent Programme for players. There's a School of Excellence that's run on a cycle of 2 years. So every 2 years, they bring in or they accept about 24, 25 referees. So I was invited to that in 2009. And there were eight modules over 2 years, basically kind of every 3 months apart. Each of them involved a fitness test, a laws of the game test, and then various modules on aspects of refereeing. And then at the end of the 2 years, a certain cohort will graduate onto the League of Ireland panel. And then those who don't will go back to their leagues, and they'll go back as better referees, fitter, more knowledgeable referees. But I was one of the few from mine in 2010 that then graduated onto the League of Ireland panel from then. And then after that, it's about, you know, we have three fitness tests a year, three laws of the game tests a year to kind of stay on the League of Ireland panel. And then after that, it's international level. It's kind of the same again. Your association will nominate you to UEFA and FIFA for international selection. And that's kind of the same as the School of Excellence process all over again at a bigger level.
Okay, yeah, I was very interested. And I'd say the amateur league, that was just the perfect place to hone your craft, as I'd say. Because you could kind of make mistakes and you could learn.
It was, and it was proper. You know, the school I work in, the lads all talk about Brexit football. I have no idea what it means, but I could venture a guess that it's very similar to what the amateur league was like in 2007, 2008. You know, a lot of route one football and hit it to the big man and get around him and, you know, last ditch defending. So no, it was the perfect place, and it's something I'm very proud of, because the amateur league didn't have a great reputation, you know. And when I went to referee there, a lot of people said, "Oh, what are you going there for?" You know, the AUL and the Leinster Senior was a better standard, but I think the amateur league had a huge part, because I like to think in some ways they were tougher games. You were going to tougher areas maybe, and because the standard of football was lower, it was more competitive, it was more physical. There was probably a bit more refereeing to it than some games that you'd get in intermediate league maybe. So definitely I would think it had a huge part in certainly honing skills. And like that, allowing me to make mistakes, because that was something that was said to me. There was a team called Drumcondra Juniors. They were based out of Ballybock, and they were a really difficult team to referee for lots of referees, but I always got on well with them. And I'll never forget one guy said to me, I don't know how it ever got out, but he'd heard I was going to the League of Ireland, and he said, "Oh, you'll be missed." And I said, "Jesus, thanks very much." You know, I said, "It's not often you hear that." He said, no. He said, "I mean that." He said, "Look, of all the referees we'd get through a season," he said, "we can talk to you for 90 minutes. And he said, "you're always up at play." And they were kind of the two things that I'd said from the start, that I'd like to be able to talk to people and obviously stay up at play. And after that, I think you've got a lot of players on your side, you know.
Yeah, I'd say that, because you have to be a people person, aren't you, kind of, to be a referee? Because you're obviously a teacher as well. You're dealing with different personalities. So I think that would be like probably an underrated trait that you'd need as a referee.
Yeah. I mean, look, some people aren't, you know, there's like, even our players will tell you, we have a forum now with the players four times a season. It started at the end of last season, where we would meet the players from the PFAI, you know, and we discuss all sorts of things. But that's something that they would have said to us, is that, well, we can talk to some of you, but we can't talk to others. So while we would say it would be a very important tool, some referees are more comfortable communicating and others aren't. Others don't like too much talk. So it all depends on personality, because, I mean, we are all different. But I think mine has certainly come from a combination of my career outside of football. You know, being a teacher, you have to communicate as a teacher with all sorts of different people at all sorts of different points in their life, and points of conflict and points of no conflict. So for me, refereeing and teaching has gone hand in hand, and being a referee has helped me be a better teacher, and being a teacher has helped me be a better referee.
So Rob, before we bring you on to your next level, and that's a great pathway we have to bring it through, let's bring it back a little bit for the question of, give us one of your howlers. Give us one of them decisions where you went off. It might be when you started off young, whatever it was, but the one that sticks out.
The one, I mean, most of my career has been League of Ireland, so the examples stand out from there. I gave a penalty in the playoff last season between UCD and Waterford. The game was played in Richmond Park, and it was very close to the 90th minute. UCD were winning 1-0, and I got caught. A corner had been taken quickly, and I'd got caught in a bad position. And usually if a ball is played into the penalty area, the best thing to do is kind of step back to get a wider perspective on things. And I got caught with a quick corner and hadn't got the time to step back. And a shot came in, and from my position, it looked like it hit the outstretched arm of the UCD player. So I'd given the penalty. And, in hindsight, you kind of say to yourself, you shouldn't guess. But I didn't guess. From where I was, it was a clear penalty. From the angle that I had and the position that I had, I was fully convinced it had hit him on the arm. So if that's what I think, I have to give that. I can't say, maybe I'm not sure. I was certain it had hit him on the arm. So I awarded a penalty. UCD were quite clearly annoyed. They didn't step over the line, and they had a right to be annoyed when I look back at it. And it was 1-0 in a playoff, and that would have made it 1-1. You kind of think you need your luck in sometimes, that the player from Waterford missed the penalty. As I've done with kind of any significant mistakes or any mistakes that I think, not significant, but kind of maybe big ones, I will always tell the players, which I do, I look at it again, after a match, and we might not see each other for a few weeks, but I look at it. And if I'm wrong, I'll absolutely apologize to you. Because there's nothing to try to hide behind it. I mean, our games are so not televised, but our games are everywhere. So the game ended with UCD fortunately won at 1-0, and the decision didn't have an impact on the game. But I watched, I went home. It was a Friday night, and the game came up on Huddle on Saturday, and I went straight to the penalty. And I was, you wanted the ground to swallow you up. But then again, you thanked your lucky stars that it didn't impact the game, because if it did, I don't want to say it was a really bad decision. It was a wrong decision. And it could have had far more consequences than it did, only like that, like a player, like a manager. Little bit of luck gets you out of a hole sometimes. But that was one afterwards where I was really, really disappointed. And like I spoke, but maybe the learning from it was, when I looked back at the clip, it was then I realized, my mental concentration had lapsed for a second. I'd missed a quick corner. I got caught in a position, and I wasn't able to do anything about it. Whereas if I'd have been more tuned in, I would have been able to see the corner taken quickly. I could have backpedaled out of the penalty area an awful lot quicker. And I would have had the view that the camera had, which showed that it actually hit him almost nearly on the shoulder blade. It was quite, not drastically far away from handball, but it was clearly not handball when I look back at it, So that's probably the most recent one that stands out, yeah. And it's difficult because we don't have as many teammates to dig us out of a hole, and it was a crowded penalty area. I mean, I wouldn't have expected an assistant referee to say to me, Rob, you've got that wrong, because I would have been certain that I had a better view than them anyway. That's kind of one, and that was last November, maybe the year before. No, either last November or the year before.
You said something there, Rob, and this is me with my referee's hat on now, saying, your concentration might have been slightly off. Right. That's how hard it is to be a referee, because if you have to be concentrated for that full 90 plus minutes, like, teams can have a rest as soon as the ball's gone out, you have to be still switched on. If it's thrown in early, are you in the right position? Is it being switched? Players can have a rest when they switch the ball, when they move the ball, whatever the case may be, or that the opposition team can have a breather.
Yeah.
How hard is your concentration levels have to be?
Oh, it is. It's mentally draining. I mean, I would struggle to sleep when I've come home from a match, just for the sole reason that you've been so mentally tuned in for, it might only be, an hour and a half, or it might be 100 minutes, depending on the game. But like you rightly said, the ball goes out for a throw-in in an attacking area. The defenders can kind of creep up to the halfway line. The goalkeeper or the left ball switches it to the right mid. He can, he just trots in and takes up his position. But the game is constantly going for us. And maybe something, Paul, that people don't understand that at our level now is we're in a situation where we have 9 full-time teams, and Drogheda are moving towards it. So in a year or two, Drogheda would be full-time. So players have all week, and coaches have all week to prep for games. At the moment in Ireland, the League of Ireland referees were contracted, but we have full-time jobs. You wouldn't survive on the refereeing salary alone. So like we've mentioned before, I'm a teacher, which is a job that does the same kind of thing. It demands, you know, if I'm having a tired day or a hungover day, I can't go in and turn the phone off and sit behind a computer. And usually on a Friday, you know, like my last class now this year ends on a Friday at 2:35. So if I have a game in Dublin, I'm still working up to 3 o'clock and then trying to get a meal in. I'm trying to get a bit of rest. I have two young kids. I might try to have to sort something with them. And then you're getting on the road for a match. Or if it's a match in Derry or Cork or Sligo or Galway, I'm leaving work early with, you know, the great help that my school has given me over the years. I'm changing from teaching gear into my refereeing gear in the school. I'm getting in the car. I'm in the car for 3 hours. You know, you're concentrating on driving. You're trying to get something, you know, in Derry, we'd stop in Monaghan for half an hour. You're trying to get a quick bit of grub in there so that you're not eating too close to the game. And look, these aren't excuses. They're just the realities of it. But I think sometimes that they're realities that maybe aren't seen. And like you said, it is before, like you said, it's very easy to criticize a referee from the side of a pitch. And I talked about awareness for parents, but I would certainly think there's from what I hear from them on the rare occasion, there's a large cohort of League of Ireland fans who I think they just think we show up on a Friday and ruin their weekend. You know, they don't realize some of the stresses and pressures. And like players, we'd have stresses and pressures from everyday life. You know, we might have had a bad week in work. We might have a sick child. We might have had a row. You know, there could be all sorts of things that you're bringing into a game like a player. But I come back to a player will have 10 teammates on the pitch. He can maybe take a break every now and again. And again, I'm not saying it's an excuse, but it's a reality that I'm not sure everybody sees.
Yeah, no, it's not. Because as me coming, sorry, Trevor, bring it in now. As a young referee, as a new referee, I'll say, one of the biggest challenges that I found that I didn't realise, Rob, was, and you're talking about offside now, how hard you'd find to go back to offside. The challenge and stuff I had was trying to keep my eye on the ball, where I was trying to go, oh, I'll have a little scan and see if there's somebody offside. And as soon as I took that scan, smack, went into a challenge. Oh, I'm at the missing the tackle here.
Yeah.
And then you're saying, right, I'll learn from that one now. I say, so keeping you in the ball, and all of a sudden, is that a great run in behind? Standing in there offside? Like, it's so hard.
And it is. I go back to what I said earlier. When I referee on my own, and there's no other way to put it, but if I'm refereeing a game on my own, it is educated, but it's guesswork. Offside on your own is entirely guesswork. Like that, you're hoping for a defender that's keeping everybody on or somebody who's run too early, but the vast majority of times, like you said, if you're taking your eye off the ball, you're waiting for the sound of the ball being kicked and you're trying to judge it off that. But it is a near impossibility to have a fully accurate call when you don't have assistance there to help you out. And it is, they're the things that you kind of get used to. Now you might try listen for the sound of the ball but one day you will get caught out. There are times where you'll get absolutely caught out and a fella will be on the ground because you've turned too quickly, or you keep your eye on the ball too long and you lift your head. And it's a fella who might look 10 yards offside, but he might have started his run early. And it is, and I'm glad, like I said earlier on, it is the most difficult thing as an individual referee that you kind of become complacent with when you have assistants then with you.
Trev, sorry, you were going to come in there.
Yeah, just on the point that you're saying about your match day routine, it was a question I was going to ask, but you explained it perfectly. It's I'm glad you got the chance to, and I hope people listen to this and realise, you know, everyone talks about the players and all that, and rightly so, but my God, you know, when you think about what's involved there, and as I say, if you have a game in Derry or not even a game in Derry, if you're playing, if you're refereeing a Dublin derby, it's still the mental stuff that you have to go through on a daily basis. The question I suppose I have is with all of that, and you said it yourself, you could be having a bad day, you have young children, you know, you're fighting traffic, you're whatever, you have to sort that all out. If you have a situation, and it's a question I'm sure that we all ask, how do you deal with the criticism, you know, because if you're like, we all have our good days, we all have our bad days. If you're having a bad day, whether it be mentally or just tiredness or whatever, and then someone just pokes the bear, what do you do, or how do you cope with it?
You have to kind of park it. And this is what I come back to about my advice to young referees about having kind of a support structure. Like I said, I'm fortunate that every game I referee, there's a team of four of us on it. So I would be very open and honest with my colleagues, and I'd like to think that they would say that as well. I could walk into a dressing room. We tend to meet an hour and a half before kickoff. if the game is local. If it's obviously on the road, we might be traveling together or we might meet up a bit earlier. But I would be very open and I would tell them, I would say, I'm after having an awful day in work. And you'd try and vent then. You might try and get some of your angst out. And then there's some games where maybe you need to keep the bit of angst in because, like I said, you know that maybe if it's a game later on in the season and there's more at stake, you might need a bit of angst to throw back. But certainly, you do have to try park it because you can't, like players, like coaches, you can't allow external factors external factors to influence what's happening on the pitch, because the players deserve better than that, and so do the coaches and the spectators, and so do we ourselves. If things outside of a game are impacting me on a Friday night, then I probably shouldn't be doing that game, or I probably should have come off the game for whatever given reason. And because it does and will only lead to not a subpar performance, but it's Sod's law that you'll have had a bad week, you'll have hemmed and hawed, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, you'll go out and then something will happen with the game. And you look back and you'll go, well, yeah, you know, all the signs are pointed that I probably should have given the boss a call and said, look, I'm just not in, you know, I'm not in great health at the minute, or the kids are sick and I'm juggling and I'm stressed out this week or whatever. Because we're quite flexible like that. Like if we rang the referee manager and said, look, this has happened, you know, we're humans. And like I said, we have full-time jobs outside of this. So they're very standard like that. But it is difficult. And in terms of dealing with the criticism, I mean, that's a really tough one to learn. And certainly in school, I see it with lads. I would not want to be a teenage boy or girl nowadays with the volume of their life that's spent on social media. You know, and certainly for us, I mean, to some extent, we are there to be critiqued. But I came off Twitter anyway, for a start. Twitter to me was the worst of the lot of them, because it's so public. And again, I come back to, there's so many things people say in a social media sphere that are actually like incorrect in law. You know, they've completely said something false, but it's the narrative that maybe suits what's happened to their team that week. And you can't engage with it to begin with, because I mean, we're not allowed to, but also you don't want to. So I came off Twitter to begin with. I have private social media pages on others, but that doesn't stop people trying to critique. Like I've shown this to lads in school when we're looking at maybe something to do with bullying in school. Like I've had death threats on social media. I've had death threats on Facebook. I've had people mention my children in posts. Like I'm very private about that. I mean, people know I have children and my friends know who they are. I don't put pictures of them up on social media, just simply because, you know, I know it's a bit of humor, but who wants their dad to be a referee? Do you know what I mean? I've inflicted that on them rather than them choosing it. So, and I remember being very, not disturbed, but just had a very strong emotional reaction to a comment that I just happened to see somehow where somebody had mentioned. It wasn't even a hugely bad comment. They'd said that I was a very good referee, and then a few months ago, my wife had a kid, and I'd been terrible since. Now, like that, it's not the worst criticism to get, and it's an opinion. There's far worse things have been said. But what really hit me about that comment was this was a person who I had absolutely no idea who they were, but they knew something very personal about my home life.
Yeah.
Now, that's, you know, the other ones have been quite direct. There's been comments online and comments to, you know, DM requests and Facebook Messenger requests that kind of you only find if you go looking for them. But I'd have a dozen, you know, two dozen of them where worse things have been said. And I tell this to the lads in school, you know, about them online. People kind of forget that when they're putting something up from their own page, they might delete it, but I still have it. I've actually kept them just for my own records, you know. Like I'm not going to, but I could give you names of people. I could give you clubs. I could tell you where they live. And for some of them, I could actually tell you who their employers are because it's on their page. And I do wonder when comments like that come in, I do wonder, do the people not realize when they're doing that? So it is very, very difficult to deal with. I avoid social media. It can be fantastic for catching highlights of matches or seeing goals very quickly or for keeping in touch with lots of referee friends I have around Europe. But certainly it's probably the worst place for criticism. And it would be my advice to any referee would be to avoid it, because people will praise you, but they'll never go online and stick their neck out in front of their mates or their fan group and say, do you know what? I thought he had a great game. Because they don't want to be the pariah in their group praising a referee. And it's far easier to sit behind a keyboard and say he was terrible and this is why. So yeah, like that kind of would come into maybe awareness. for young referees to somewhere to avoid, because we see what it's like in the Premier League, and we see what the stuff is like all around Europe with that in other countries. We're not there yet, but you know, I wouldn't say we're a million miles away from it when you read some of the stuff online, because it's very similar to other countries.
Can I ask on that, Rob? Like, with just what you said is actually shocking, an absolute shock. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no question about it. With the courses that you do every year, and you're kind of always obviously upskilling and all that kind of stuff, like you should, and like we would expect, surely there's something or some part of that course or a course itself that involves, because that's bullying, obviously, it's even more than that. Is there, like, for as Paul was saying, as young fellas coming up, or young referees or boys or girls are looking to get into it, is there stuff, is there a kind of a wellness, kind of a mental wellness kind of area that is looked after? Or if there's not, do you think, obviously there should be?
Yeah, kind of informally there is, but, you know, we would have had talks at different times from sports psychologists. You know, Seamus Kelly, who played with Bowes years ago and Longford for a while, he's now a lecturer out in UCD in sports psychology, and he's done a few bits with us, and she'll have to forgive for forgetting her surname. Olivia might come back to me later. She has a PhD in sports psychology. She works at a UCD as well, and she's done kind of infrequent stuff with us. And when I say infrequent, I think we had two sessions with her a few years ago, and with Seamus Kelly, it was one. So there's no kind of structurally organized one. And it's certainly something that absolutely should be there, because put my teaching hat back on, the big thing in secondary schools now is well-being. It's about building those structures, about how to recognize when you're down, how to have your support groups, who to go to, when to go to them. And I come back again to the advice I gave about, you know, a young referee or any referee starting. The vast amount of sports psychology I would do would be with other referees on an informal basis, because the reality is we've all been down the same road. And now I'm not just talking about, you know, receiving abuse and stuff, but making mistakes and games not going well or games going well. It really is a fraternity, you know, or a community. We kind of equate it to being, we're all in the trenches together as referees, you know. But certainly it is something, it's something that should be. I mean, it's there for players. The PFAI have connections as well that they do for the players. And look, I'm sure if I went to the association and said, listen, this is happening to me and I'm really struggling with it, particularly now that we're contracted employees, I'm sure that the FAI have procedures in place for that, but I haven't availed of them. I haven't gone down that line yet. But it is definitely something there, because I think social media has a huge impact on it. You know, like particularly, like I said, younger people, the vast majority of their life is lived on social media, and it can be such a toxic place. And like I said earlier, you know, people who've said things about me, you know, like I said, I've had, I don't want to, of the 20 or so comments that I've had that I've kept, you know, lots of them are bad. I think there were only two that mentioned anything related to death. I don't take them seriously. I don't believe that they are death threats per se. They're not nice to read. But they're said and they're out there and they have to be dealt with, and people have said them, you know, and you kind of think, do the people who say that realize that, like, that I've come from a working job all week and I've gone back to a family and I'm disappointed, particularly if it's around a controversial decision that maybe I've got wrong. I'm also disappointed with that decision. We're not immune from criticism. We're not infallible. I make a bad decision, I will know very, very quickly. You know, halftime or after the game, once I get a chance to look it back, I will know that it's a wrong decision and I'll have to deal with it on top of the... I don't want to say I don't need the criticism, but at the level that we're at, we don't. We know our mistakes and we deal with them as soon as we see them.
Very good, very good. The that's shocking stuff to hear as well, so it's good to get your point of view on that, Rob. It really is. We'll move on to, as you say, a wrong decision, Rob. Is there any controversy? Have you ever come across a card which a fourth official where, you know, he's gone in to give you a dig out and then you've gone, no, I'm staying with my own decision? Does that happen a lot?
Yeah, it does. Not a lot, but it does. I mean, so like I said, we would meet an hour and a half before every game and you're looking at team sheets. The kits kind of now are done online, so we just confirm them once we get to the ground. We'll then go and walk the pitch. We bring the communication system out to make sure it works. You know, we'll have a look at the regular stuff, that the pitch is playable and the nets and all that kind of stuff. And then we'll have a chat, and it usually lasts, kind of can range between 10 and 15 minutes, depending on the game that it is. It's a sentence in my instructions that I would give to officials any game. It's offer your opinion wherever it is on the pitch. You know, some people will categorize and they say, well, for this assistant, you go 10 yards and you offer me stuff there. And the assistant on the far side, you're limited to that space in front of you. But when I'm talking to my two assistants on the fourth official, I will tell them, if you see something on the pitch, offer your opinion. The more opinions, the better, because the closer we are to having the correct decision. But also I would tell them, once you've offered your opinion, your job is done. You can do no more than offer your opinion. If I go with it, then I've gone with it because I agree with it. But if I don't go with it, don't take it personally. And if my decision turns out to be the one that's wrong, I will say to the observer, yeah, do you know what? Paul told me it was a yellow card. I thought I could get away with it. But looking back at it, I should have given a yellow card. And that was my mistake, not Paul's. He did give me the information. And I'd like to think that over the years I've been involved, anyone who's working with me will know that that's how I would operate. Because, you want your assistants and your fourth official offering you what they see. The last thing you want is a mute fourth official or a mute assistant, because then they're no good to anybody. But it comes down to reassuring them that once you've offered your opinion, your job is done. And I'm not going to hang you out to dry if I'm wrong. I'm not going to turn around and say, oh, well, Paul said nothing. You know, because nobody gains anything from that. So we would have differences of opinion. And sometimes the level of the official would come into that. You know, if it's a higher profile game, more often than not, it will be another FIFA official or an experienced Premier Division referee. But maybe if it's a lower profile game, you might have a referee who's refereeing in the first division and he's fourth official in the Premier Division every now and again to get the experience. And you're kind of thinking to yourself, well, I know I've substantially more experience. It doesn't mean I'll always be right. But certainly in a certain situation, I might judge it differently just because of experience. I might know that, yeah, listen, this is one that I can get away with. Like that. This could be a yellow card that Rob Harvey, who's been refereeing in the Premier Division for 10 years, could get away with. But it might not be a card that a referee who's done his fourth or fifth game in the Premier Division, he might have to give it because the players are only getting to know him and he has to build up a reputation for himself.
Excellent answer. Lads, you just want to bounce in. I feel like I'm asking all the questions there, so I don't need Robin any of your questions. And now Scott is getting his hand up there.
Yeah, no, look, obviously, the stuff about the abuse is shocking. It's honestly, from attending games, I don't think it's actually that shocking, Rob. You know, you hear it when you're in the crowds, you hear the abuse the referees get, and I don't know if you probably don't hear because you're in your own zone there.
You don't, and, yeah. You don't. I mean, the most abuse I would hear tends to be when I'm walking onto the pitch or walking off at halftime or full-time, you know, because the rest of it is noise. And like I said, with crowds being much higher now, it does just kind of become collective noise, yeah.
Yeah, so look, you know, we've talked probably about the criticisms and the struggles of being a referee, but in terms of yourself, like what games, I presume the FAI Cup final a few years back was a really proud moment of yours. It just or the UEFA games you've done so far. So if you'd like to outline which ones you've like, you know, you're the proudest of.
Yeah, I mean, like I've been fortunate getting into refereeing young was probably one of the best things because I had, you know, I had the opportunity to progress as much as possible. In 2015, I was nominated for an international badge and FIFA accepted it. So in 2016, I became one of our four FIFA referees. And then once you're a FIFA referee, you can referee, you know, any international game. Obviously, there's categories, but you can referee international games, under 21, under 17, under 19, and then all of the club European games. So in terms of ones that kind of have stood out, I mean, you might remember Alan Kelly was probably our most successful referee in the modern era in terms of the volume of games he did. But Alan Kelly went to the MLS in January 2014. And we hadn't had a group stage game in Europe after Alan left until 2019. So I got appointed to a Europa League group stage game between Malmo and Lugano from Switzerland in October 2019. And that was a hugely proud moment, obviously, for me individually. But also I felt like I'd kind of broken a glass ceiling that had been built after Alan had left because Alan was so successful. And like I said, it had been 5 years without a game. So that was a hugely proud moment for me and for the team. And like that, we were representing our country. You know, when we go out to any game in Europe, I always feel like, right, it might only be refereeing in Ireland, but I'm refereeing my country in a certain way. Then on top of that, so that was in the Europa League, and then I've refereed three group stage games in the Conference League, and again, all group stage appointments are hugely prestigious, and they're where you want to be because of the extra things that kind of come around them. I mean, I remember just being completely dumbstruck by walking out onto the pitch in Malmo and hearing the Europa League music that I'd only ever heard in the ads on TV3, you know, when it goes to an ad break. And you're kind of walking out onto the pitch and the hair on the back of the neck stands up and you're saying, I'm in one of these now. I'm not, there's other people watching at home on TV now. So they were hugely proud moments. So yeah, I've fortunately refereed four group stage games in club competition. I refereed a number of senior qualifiers in different European championships. I refereed Sweden and Malta in a Euro 2020 qualifier. It's been a great weekend for you, Scott. United won the Europa League in the Friends Arena the Saturday night before. And then on the Wednesday after, Sweden were playing Malta, and I refereed that one. That was 45,000 people. And I remember staying in the hotel that we stayed in, actually connected to the stadium. You could walk from a level of the hotel into the stadium. And we'd gone for lunch and we'd come back, and I was sitting in the hotel and I was just sitting at a chair by the window, and the fan zone was right outside our stadium. And myself and the lads went over, and it's a mad memory, but it's just a really special one. There was the Mall of Scandinavia is beside the stadium. It's a massive mall, but they had a two-story bar that had 20 pool tables and bowling alleys. And myself, Paul, Mark and Wayne, who were my team at the time, we went over at about 2 o'clock and we played 2 hours of pool. And there were thousands of fans around us. And we were all just kind of looking at each other saying, you know, if only they knew, do any of these know who we are?
They've no idea.
No idea. We were about to ruin their evening, you know. but that just in terms of like the country, you know, refereeing the Swedish national team in their home stadium. And then, Gibraltar and Georgia in a Nations League game, and Luxembourg and Moldova in a Nations League game. And I'll kind of come back to, you know, I know I've talked about some of the negative sides of it, and I don't think very many referees get the level of abuse maybe that we get, and it is few and far between. Like I said, I'm the League of Ireland 14 years. I've had two comments that ever mentioned anything significant like that. So I kind of think that that's not too bad, you know. But certainly the positives are, and I say this having mentioned that I was a B-team goalkeeper earlier on, refereeing has allowed me or brought me to referee games that I would have only ever been able to watch if I'd have paid into. You know, there's just something, and that's international level at you know, club group stage games, coming back to League of Ireland. You know, I get to share a pitch with, in the League of Ireland, with the best players in this country. Refereeing Sweden, I got to share a pitch with Sweden's best players at that time. And there is something absolutely incredible about that. And that's something that I would say. And look, not obviously all referees who will do that will get to that level. It's the simple reality of it. But certainly refereeing has allowed me to partake in games that I would have had to pay in. And kind of, as we often say, after playing, being a referee is the next best seat in the house. You know, it's the next best spot. Like I said, those national teams and this summer, or last summer, I was picked to referee Celtic and Wolves in the Aviva. You know, Celtic were a week out from the start of their season. They were at full tilt. And Wolves are you know, doing well in the Premier League. And you're on a pitch with Premier League players. You're on a pitch with Scottish Premier League players, internationals. And you're looking around and you're saying, geez, if I hadn't been refereeing, I wouldn't be here. But, I'd be paying 55 quid or whatever to come in and watch it. So that's one of the huge positives is that I've been fortunate to share a pitch with some of the best players from particular countries or clubs or leagues. And it's a hugely privileged position as well. You know, it's a hugely privileged position.
Yeah. But I think, can I just come in there with regards to that? Like you've been privileged, but you've earned the right, you know, let's not forget, like you're not going to you've earned the right and you're there on merit. So it's all credit to you. Like, you know, and obviously, you've already kind of mentioned, and I've already kind of touched on this, like, you know, it doesn't happen with just you. Obviously, your team that you're on the day, but it's also your partner, your kids, your family who are allowing you to do this. So it's the bigger picture. So when you're going out there, whatever about the League of Ireland, which is massive, But you're going out there and you're representing your country. Like, I mean, there's no higher praise than that. So fair play to you. Like, I don't want to kind of cut across you because you're flowing with information that we couldn't have known. So I'm really, really appreciated. Yeah, no, thanks. I don't really have a question. I just wanted to say that. That's all.
Go on, Scott.
Paul, you got to go in there?
No, sorry. I thought you were going to say something there. I think Rob was going to say something.
No, probably just one last few questions. Rob, have you done a VAR game yet?
I have, yeah. So in 2019, UEFA ran an initial pilot program to train referees in VAR that didn't have it in their league. So back in 2019, we were probably one of maybe a dozen countries in Europe who hadn't implemented VAR yet. So I was selected from Ireland. I was the only representative from Ireland at the time. And that was another incredible experience. It was three different modules. So the first one was 4 days training out with the Dutch Association out in their headquarters. And then the next two, one was in September, one was in October, one was in November. The second two, we were brought to Turkey to their headquarters. And it's all just practice. You're on situations that have happened, but they take the audio out and they want you to work through the situation. So 2019, UEFA certified me to be able to referee in a game with VAR. But I couldn't be certified as a VAR because we don't use it in our country. And that kind of, in some ways, it was great because it gave me that opportunity. But in other ways, it not that it hamstrung me a little, but we no one else in Ireland trained. So then in 2021, the next kind of time they rolled it out, they selected Rob Hennessy from the League of Ireland as well. So now in the League of Ireland, myself and Rob Hennessy are both trained as VAR officials, to referee in a game involving VAR. So in terms of VAR, I have refereed three games with VAR. One was Gibraltar and Georgia in the Nations League, and the VAR was David Coote from the Premier League. And then I refereed, second one's escaping me, the third one then was a Conference League group stage game, Slovako from Czech Republic against Partizan Belgrade. And again, the VAR was David Coote. And then Rob has refereed one game with VAR. His was a Nations League game last summer, the Faroe Islands against Luxembourg. And the VAR was an Italian guy. I have refereed games with VAR. And then this summer, in February, we were invited over to the Premier League in Stockley Park. So they are now training people, the same kind of idea. They're training up people to be certified to use it. But with this training program, they will certify us to be a VAR. And now, again, I kind of come back to the reality is, you know, the analogy I use quite often is it's like having a driving license and no car. Because in the League of Ireland, we don't have it. And we're at the moment, it's not on the horizon for the next year or two. People might not realize, but in order to have VAR in your league, match officials have to do a year's training before it's implemented. So we call it offline training. So if we were to implement it, if we were to decide now to bring it in, the earliest we'd have it would be season 2026, because we'd have to train offline season 2025 and then bring it in. So I kind of always talk about that we're at least 2 years away from it, really. Some of the issues in Ireland are that they're kind of well-publicized, just the facilities that we have, the lack of facilities, I suppose. I'm trained and ready to go and available for any opportunities that do come in. But now the situation in 2024 is that we're one of, when UEFA trained me, there was maybe a dozen, so it wasn't as many. But in 2024, I think we're one of five countries in Europe that don't have it. So the simple logic is that UEFA, not that they'd be reluctant to appoint you, but they have now a significant amount of referees operating with it on a weekly basis. At present, the League of Ireland doesn't fall into one of those leagues. So it does certainly make it a bit more difficult for us to progress or to be involved in those decisions when it comes to appointing referees to games where VAR is being used, because every year it's rolled out in more and more competitions, and that kind of minimizes our possibilities more and more as well.
So Paul, do you have something to come in there?
No, I was just going to say in the VAR, Rob, it's the topic of discussion big time, the VAR. As a referee, when you're refereeing them games, do you feel the game is getting delayed much more, or do you think there's still a flow to it, or what way do you see, or what way does it feel, or does it just feel natural?
I mean, look, the reality is, yeah, it does affect the flow of a game to an extent, but, you know, as I've often said before to people in just personal conversation, people criticize referees for years, and now there is a product that improves the accuracy of refereeing decision-making. Now, there's studies have been done all around Europe and around the Premier League that the accuracy of refereeing decisions is above 90% to begin with. And with VAR, it improved a little bit more, maybe a percent or two. So it hasn't had a huge change in terms of the accuracy. It has made it more accurate, but obviously the more accurate you are, the less room there is to improve upon that. Certainly, the delays are part and parcel of the decision. If it's a more contentious decision, there's going to be a longer delay. But the reality is for clubs and countries, if a decision is taken long to review, it's because it's an important decision. And if that decision goes, not that it goes in your favour, but you want those really contentious ones to be correct. So in the game, I refereed a game. It was a second leg playoff. Bodo Glimt from Norway played a team called Sepsi from Romania. And Bodo Glimt ended up progressing on aggregate by one goal. But in that match, we had a disallowed goal for offside for Sepsi, which actually would have won them the game in normal time. And when VAR used crosshair to draw the lines, the assistant had disallowed the goal. But obviously, we'd played, the ball had hit the back of the net. The assistant put up his flag then. And then obviously, it gets reviewed. And the technology showed us that the Sepsi player was offside by 7 centimetres. So in the law, he was offside and the decision was correct. But that took over a minute to be correct. Not corrected. It was the correct decision was made on the pitch. But VAR had to make sure that it was the correct decision. And we also had a decision in the first half where a goal had been scored by the home team and we had allowed it. But it had been pulled back from the goal line and my assistant had said it's in play, and then VAR checked it and the ball was, when I say crosshair again, the technology showed it was about 5 centimetres out of play, and we're talking, you know, like 5 centimetres is nothing to the eye really. So those two decisions took a while to be verified. And obviously in one case it was the disallowed goal and in the other case it was to verify a disallowed goal. But the reality is people want to critique refereeing decisions. Then a product comes in that will help those decisions to be more correct. You kind of, you know, it's hypocritical then to criticize it. And let's be honest about it. Referees and leagues are very aware that it affects the match day experience. I mean, we were in the PGMOL in February and they spoke about regularly about wanting to improve fan experience. So something that happens in 18 of the 20 Premier League grounds is that they will show the VAR situations on a screen. But without naming them, there are 2 Premier League clubs who do not have a screen in their stadium. So fan experience there is lesser because they're waiting. At least in a ground where there's a screen, fans can look at that and they can see actively what's happening and they can understand the process and maybe understand why it's taken even longer. But in a ground where you don't have a screen, you can't do that. And the fan just has to stand there and watch. And of course, standing there, you're going to get more impatient. You know, so it does affect fan experience and it does affect games at certain times. But the reality is people criticize refereeing and people said for a long time, they've Hawkeye in cricket and they've got, you know, the touch judge and referee, not the touch, the video referee in rugby. Why can't we have something like that? Now we do. And now people want to criticize that as well. So maybe there's a hidden message in there that refereeing criticism is infinite or will never end. I don't know, but.
I've just 2 quick fire questions before we finish up, Rob. But the first thing, I know one of the grounds you're speaking of is Anfield, because as a Liverpool fan, I know that for a fact. But I don't understand why. I mean, what is the logic? What's the idea behind not showing it? Because as you say, if you know, in the Premier League or in the Championship or whatever, the amount of money that's spent to get these decisions right, whether it be a minute or two, or if you look at the international, there's also money involved there, but just the, yeah, everything about it, I just don't understand it. But anyway, my two final questions are, who would be, you know, with all the players that you would have reffed, who would be up there as one of the best, and what ground that you would have reffed over the years would be your favourite?
Mm. In terms of players, I mean, obviously, refereeing international games, then you're with a higher caliber of player, I suppose. The lads in school love that I've refereed the Georgian winger. He plays with Napoli. I get to me, but I didn't want to make a Hames of a surname. But I refereed him against Gibraltar. I refereed Isak against Sweden. Unfortunately, Ibrahimovic was on. He'd had a row with the manager previous to that, and he'd taken a retirement, and then he came back from that, so he wasn't playing for Sweden at the time. And then, I mean, in some of the friendlies, like, I've been involved in a couple of games. I was fourth official in the Aviva for Celtic and Barcelona when Messi played. And I was fourth official in the Aviva when Liverpool played Bilbao a few years ago. So you get to see, that was when Liverpool's front three was Salah, Mane and Firmino. And, like, yes, it was a friendly, and as good as they look on television, it is mind-boggling how quickly they move and just the level that they're at when you're that close to them, you know. So yeah, certainly, I've had the fortune of being involved in games like that where, you know, the lads would often ask me, school Messi or Ronaldo, and I like to throw back at them, well, Messi, because I shared a pitch, you know. Scale on that one, that until maybe, you know, I ever get there for Ronaldo, but that's the sole separator in them for me. And then, look, like, I, you know, it's difficult to talk about players in our own league because I'm still actively refereeing, but our league is awash with high quality players, and we've seen how quickly players can go over and have a big impact. I mean, you look at young players like Jack Moylan, who went over from Shelburne at the end of the season, and Jesus, he's scoring goals for fun at the minute at Lincoln. And you look at other players like Luke McNally, and you know, I would have taught Luke in school, and the season he had last season with Coventry, and the season he had before that with Oxford. And people, you know, criticise our league, and they like to criticise our league, and then players go over, and all of a sudden they're hitting the lights out in other countries at standards that people think are much higher and impossible to attain for League of Ireland players. Mm-hmm. So yeah, look, certainly those handful of players, the Liverpool ones in particular, and Messi, I suppose, are, it's hard to beat that, I think. And then, sorry, ground. Yeah. I talked a long time about players' grounds. The game in Sweden was a fantastic one. The Friends Arena, a proper full stadium, 45,000. Like I said, the Europa League final had been played there on the Saturday before. And when you're walking out on the pitch, you get struck by, one, the scale of the stadium, but also, two, kind of how close people are to you. You could make out people in the back row and the upper tier. I'm a bit of a football nerd. The football nerd in me loved. I refereed in the Shea Stadium in England, Halifax, real old classic ground. It was an under-23 friendly, and I was invited over to referee that. And just for a kind of football heritage, that was one. Again, in England, I refereed the under-17 championships in England in 2018, and I did a quarterfinal between Spain and Belgium, and it was played in Walsall's ground. And just because there were grounds I'd have seen and watching the EFL and stuff like that. And then I suppose in our own league, you know, it's the fans in our own league that make each ground. You know, I couldn't say there's one that stands out hugely above the others, because no matter what ground we're in on a Friday night, like I said, this season, they tend to be all full. And when you're refereeing, like when you're playing, you want to play in front of capacities, whether that capacity is 4,000 or 44,000, it doesn't matter. But yeah, it's in our own league, it's kind of difficult to pick out. My own, I like refereeing in stadium in Ireland where the fans are close to the pitch, and we'd have a good few of those because it just feels like there's more of an environment and it's more collective and it's more of an experience. You know, there's some grounds around the country where the fans are a bit further away and you kind of do lose a bit of the tension, and the tension can make the experience maybe even better. So certainly in my own experience, I wouldn't say that if I was an assistant now, because they'd be writing me back. At least I can run around and get away from them, but certainly, yeah, grounds where the fans are right on top of you, it makes the experience better for everyone.
Well, you clearly haven't been, you have never reffed up on the Summerhill Road there for Dunboyne. That would be on your...
No, I haven't, Trevor. And if he's having
a wish list.
We'll get you there. Well, We have a game on Sunday morning, a quarter final of a cup under 13s. If you're free, I can absolutely bring the walkie talkie and we can do VAR.
It's something.
It's mates rates. It's not like we're not paying out for the League of Ireland. Like, you know what I mean?
Oh, come here! I wouldn't be looking for any. But no, it is. It's funny. It's something I was thinking before that, like having refereed in the North Dublin, Dunboyne, and I would teach a huge amount of students. A lot of the students in my school are from Dunboyne. But just on my own travels as a player with Kevin's and as a referee in the North Dublin, Dunboyne was somewhere I never got to. Whether that's a good thing for Dunboyne or a good thing for me, I don't know.
No, it's our loss. It's our loss.
No, brilliant. Have you any questions there, lads, before we wrap it up?
No, it was a cracking interview and appreciate you coming on, Rob. Really, the insights is, you know, about the hardships of the referee, the people don't realise it. I think it's very important that you voiced it.
I don't want people going away and thinking, geez, I'd never referee because what if I get something like that? Like I said, in my entire, you know, I'm coming up to 19 years refereeing, there's probably two occasions where I've got something like that. And again, like I said, when you're refereeing at the national level, you're probably a bit more, I wouldn't say I'm known, but you know what I mean? You're on a higher profile. Mm. The people who follow our league are still kind of small and they still know a lot. But the main thing is, you know, some of my best friends now are friends I've made through refereeing. And I come back to that thing that I said, whether it's you know, you get to intermediate level, whether it's cup finals, whether it's National League, whether it's international, refereeing has at a place I would never have got. And it's given, I always come back to, it's a quote I always mention. We had a talk from Howard Webb a good few years ago, and a quote he said stuck with me. And he said, referees are just as passionate about football as anybody else. And he said, but unfortunately, referees choose to show it in the most difficult way. And I think that really does sum up refereeing, because lots of people like to think referees know nothing about football or we've no interest. I mean, I was heavily involved in a big schoolboy club. I played, I was a spectator at lots of League of Ireland games, absolutely obsessed with football, much to the detriment of my wife's social life and my kids' spare time. But it's a hugely rewarding career, for making friends, for improving your communication, your ability to deal with criticism. I mean, look, we get criticized in all walks of life. Doesn't matter what it is, at home, in your job, everywhere, on the pitch, it doesn't matter. Part and parcel of life is dealing with it. And refereeing has given me invaluable skills to be able to do that and to be able to self-analyze like a player would, to be able to look back at something and want to improve. So it is a hugely rewarding career. It's one I would recommend if anyone loses the heart with playing or loses the heart with coaching, you know, to stay in the game in whatever way possible, whether that's playing or coaching or even refereeing. We're not as bad, and it's not as bad as some people make it out to be.
Brilliant stuff, Rob. Brilliant stuff. As Scott says, and I'll just second it or even toward it, cracking interview. We are delighted to have you on. Really good insight to a lot of listeners that wouldn't understand what it's like to be a referee and a man in the middle. So we wish you all the best in your career going forward, and we hope you smash it out of the park, mate.
Thanks very much, lads. Really appreciate the invite. Really enjoyed it. All the best.
How are you? Roddy Collins here, and I listen to This Is Football podcast.